Thanks for joining us. I'm Cathy Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane's on a cruise with public radio listeners. It was almost a century ago that political leaders began calling for health care for all Americans. So the House Health Reform Bill that passed on Saturday night really has been a very long time coming. The bill would cover 96% of all Americans and cost over $1 trillion. It passed by the slimmest of margins. Joining me in the studio to discuss the vote and what's next for healthcare legislation, Janet Hook with the Los Angeles Times and Politico's Jonathan Allen. We will also have a number of congressmen calling in throughout the hour. Jonathan, Janet, thanks very much for joining me.
Good morning. Thanks.
Good morning.
And we'll be opening the phones later on in the program. 1-800-433-8850 is the phone number here. And you can also send your questions and comments, of course, by email to drshow@wamu.org. Janet, let's start by getting a sense of the significance of Saturday's healthcare vote in the House.
Well, as you said, this is really a big historical landmark. Democrats have been trying for a very, very long time to enact some kind of comprehensive change to healthcare, the healthcare system. We've had lots of big bills like the Medicare prescription drug benefit that was approved a few years ago. But really, it's not been since 1965 when Medicare was enacted that anything quite this expansive has been passed. Now, obviously, House passage is not a law. There's lots of work to be done going forward, but the last time when President Clinton tried to enact health care reform, he didn't even get a vote in the House on it. So this is a big milestone legislatively. It's not as much of a milestone as I think President Obama had hoped, because the vote in the House was quite narrow. And this had been expected to be the chamber where it would be easiest to pass a bill, because the House is generally more liberal than the Senate. And in fact, they just, as you mentioned, passed it only by the narrowest of margins.
Okay, we'll get on to who voted which way in just a minute. Jonathan, let's get before that, though, let's probably get an overview of the plan. What's in it? What's not in it?
Well, you know, it's hard. There's 2,000 pages there. What's in it? There's
a
lot
in it. You
haven't
read them all, Jonathan?
I have not read all of them. I have read a lot of summaries of it. Look, I mean, I think the basic parts of this plan are, as you mentioned, expanding health insurance coverage to most Americans who don't have it through a variety of means. The biggest thing is going to be this public option that everyone's heard so much about, and not just the option, but an insurance exchange that the option is part of. Basically, a lot of Americans are going to get new subsidies to purchase health insurance. And that's sort of the thrust of this bill. There are a lot of other pieces to it. There's efforts to sort of change the way that we do healthcare, a lot of studies of new ideas, outcomes research, things like that. But really the main thing here, I think, is this effort to insure all Americans. That's sort of the central thrust of what they're doing. And of course, to rein in what they're calling waste in the Medicare system. And a lot of that is subsidies for insurers and for other companies that have been induced into helping out with that system, particularly through what's called the Medicare Advantage program. There's a lot of debate over that, and I think the Democrats are actually getting away with cutting Medicare in a way that Republicans would have trouble politically doing, because the public trusts them to root out waste instead of cutting services for seniors. But I think that's going to be a big part of the debate going forward.
Janet, Democrats, the White House, they're all feeling very pleased with themselves this morning. But 220-15 is a very small margin they got, isn't it?
Yes, it is, because the Democrats have 249. No, I forget. Now, anyway, there's a much larger 258 Democrats in the House, and a lot of the people, the Democrats who voted against the bill, were the more conservative wing of the party. And the thing that's surprising is that not only was the margin narrow, but even to get to that point, they had to make a lot of concessions to the conservative Democrats. They sort of scaled back the scope of the public option that they offered for the government-run plan that a lot of conservatives were uneasy with. Now, and that's going to be a much more prominent feature in the Senate, where the conservative wing of the party, or the moderates, the centrists, are even more influential than they are in the House.
And only getting one Republican on board? This was, you know, bipartisan in technicality only, wasn't it, Jonathan?
It was bipartisan in technicality only. The only Republican was a guy named Joseph Gao, who represents majority black New Orleans and is a bit of an anomaly as a Republican representing that district. He succeeded a corrupt congressman who was on the ballot, and a lot of people have had him as sort of an afterthought in Congress until this moment where he crossed party lines and allowed the Democratic leaders to hold a press conference where they talked about bipartisanship. I think it's interesting what Janet was talking about in terms of the concessions that were made here. You asked what's in and what's out. One of the things that's in that's very surprising, I think, is a strict limitation on federal funding for abortions and for insurance coverage that covers abortions. That was something that Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who is known as one of the most progressive pro-choice members of the House, had to make a concession on that in order to get the bill passed. And it's in now, and it's very frustrating to people on the left, and they're saying they're going to fight it pretty hard. And I think it'll be interesting to see how that plays out in the Senate, where you have a lot of people who are sort of in the middle on abortion, who have nuanced it over the years, who vote for partial birth abortion bans, but don't vote for all-out bans on abortion, and particularly the Senate Majority Leader, Harry Reid, who has a 50% lifetime rating from the National Right to Life Committee and a very poor rating from the pro-choice group. So it'd be interesting to see how he plays this now that the House has spoken in a way that I think most people would have thought the House wouldn't speak, in a way that is very much against the ideals of a lot of the Democrats and certainly a lot of the Democratic women in the House.
Jonathan, when we look at some of those people who voted, kind of who are in the middle of the political spectrum in the House, we had 7 out of 10 of the most endangered Democrats, the people whose seats are seen as most endangered in the midterm elections, voting no on this bill. We had that one Republican, as you mentioned, voting yes, although he comes from a heavily Democratic district. This is the most important piece of medical legislation in decades, and it seems to me that a lot of people in the middle were voting on purely political grounds.
Well, I'd hate to impugn all their motives on this, and I think in each case it's individual. But what you do have is a lot of the majority makers, a lot of the Democrats who were just elected in Republican districts in the last 2 to 4 years, saying this is too much. If I go back home and try and sell this, it's going to be hard for me to win as a Democrat next time around because I campaigned as a moderate. And so going back and selling what a lot of people think is a liberal piece of legislation back home is going to be difficult. What I think is fascinating is it's not just conservative members, or it is mostly conservative members, but the geographic scope of the people voting no is interesting to me. I mean, they come from all over the country. And so I think there was a thought that it was mostly going to be limited to the deep South seats, but you have conservatives and moderates from around the country really who ended up voting against this, which should be a little bit of a signpost for Democratic leaders in terms of what they try to move going forward, not on healthcare, but maybe on other issues.
Janet, was this more of a victory for the president or for Speaker Pelosi?
Well, that's a very good question. That's a very, very good question, because I think on the legislative side, it was definitely more of a victory for Nancy Pelosi, because she was the one who really kind of went through the Democratic Party vote by vote to round up this very narrow majority. I think she couldn't have done it, though, if Obama had not made it such a big campaign issue. She's been Speaker for 2 years before President Obama got to be president, and there was no way she could have done this without any Democrat in the White House, but specifically one who made this as high a priority as President Obama has.
And did his last-minute trip down to the House on Saturday change any critical minds?
Some people have said there's been a vote or two that was changed by his appearance, but I don't think that was the principal aim there. I think that for a lot of people. Voting for the bill involved sort of swallowing hard on things that they didn't like for the sake of the larger goal, the larger vision. I mean, when you're kind of counting votes the way Nancy Pelosi did, the members are always looking at the trees. And in the end, Obama had to get them to look at the forest. You may not like that anti-abortion provision that was put in there, but this is the moment where Congress can move on healthcare, the broader goal.
Okay, well, we're joined on the phone now by Congressman Earl Pomeroy, who voted in favor of the bill. Congressman, thank you very much for joining us. You have been involved with the Democratic Blue Dog healthcare efforts. Explain your vote on Saturday evening.
Well, Gabby, I felt that this was a very critical decision point for the House on healthcare reform. Plan B essentially would have been take the thing apart and start over, which maybe some supported, but I believe that would have effectively meant no reform this Congress. That was simply unacceptable. We've got this mounting problem on health care cost. It's been slowly but surely eating our federal budget and business budgets and family budgets to death. This is a big opportunity to confront that problem. The bill got better as it went along. I think it'll get better yet in the Senate, and that's the number of us voted, not because the bill was perfection, but it was important to keep the process moving at this point in time.
In particular, Congressman, what were the elements in the bill that you found difficult to swallow?
Well, I was involved in negotiations that would say if you're going to have a public plan, it's got to act fairly. It's got to pay providers on rates that the providers are going to negotiate, like any other insurance company. We didn't want, in the name of competition, a public plan created, but on a stacked deck where it was going to win every time. I think that that improvement made it possible for me to support this bill. Also, negotiations right to the final hours of the vote with the U.S. Council of Bishops relative to the question of third-party reimbursement of elective abortion services. That issue was allowed to be squarely addressed on the House floor with an amendment offered by Bart Stupak, Congressman Stupak. Allowing the vote on that amendment, which did prevail, also was critical, I believe, to getting a number of votes for the bill.
Congressman Pomeroy, we've got a break in just a second. Tell me quickly if you think we're going to have health care legislation passed by the Senate before the end of the year.
Certainly.
Congressman Earl Pomeroy, Democrat from North Dakota. Congressman, thank you so much for joining the Diane Rehm Show.
Honored to be on.
And I'm joined also in the studio by Jonathan Allen and Janet Hook. We're discussing the House bill on health care reform that was passed on Saturday. We'll continue with more of your questions and comments. 1-800-433-8850 is the phone number. Do stay listening. Welcome back. I'm Katty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. We're discussing the House's healthcare bill that passed on Saturday night, 220 votes to 215, a pretty slim margin for the Democrats, but they are nonetheless this morning claiming this as a significant victory. And of course, it is a historic piece of legislation in the healthcare debate. I'm joined in the studio by Jonathan Allen from Politico. Janet Hook is also with me from the LA Times. Just before the break, we were listening to Congressman Earl Pomeroy, who voted in favor of the bill. Janet, was there anything that the congressman said that particularly struck you?
Well, actually, one thing that he didn't mention that I believe is very important to people from states like North Dakota is that there's a there was a lot of concern before the bill was finalized and passed among members that come from rural areas because they were concerned that the public option would make it financially very difficult for hospitals in rural areas. And I bring that up mostly because it's one other dimension of this debate that isn't very visible, but it's very powerful, which is the regional question. This has mostly been portrayed as a Republican versus Democratic issue, but within the Democratic Party, the regional disparities are tremendous, and we'll see more of that when the bill goes to the Senate, where rural states tend to have more power, and that's part of the reason why the public option, having a government insurance program as part of the bill is even more problematic in the Senate because the rural areas are most resistant to it and they have a bigger voice in the Senate.
Okay, let's talk a little bit more about the abortion controversy, which sort of threatened to hold things up over the course of the weekend. It didn't come out of the blue, but I think it caused more of a hiccup than people had imagined it was going to. We've got an email here on the subject. And the question is, this is from Timothy, who writes to us, how does the legislation meet the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops' requirements on abortion?
It does meet their requirements on abortion. I mean, one of the fascinating things, elements of what was going on here is this coalition, this loose, very, very loose coalition of the left, which wanted the health care bill done, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, which very desperately also wanted the health care bill done, but not if it allowed for federal funding of abortions in any way. I think the way that Congressman Pomeroy put it was third-party reimbursement for abortion services. But you also then had the National Right to Life Committee outside of that, also part of this, wanting to make sure that they got a vote on the House floor so they could figure out where all the members are, and wanting to make sure that that language got into the bill, and being willing from their part to put pressure on Republicans to vote for the amendment to not mess with the possibility of getting the bill done. And so you had all these forces that were sort of generally on opposite sides of an issue, kind of winking and nodding at each other, working with each other in a lot of cases, particularly the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, which essentially ended up being the middleman between the National Right to Life type folks and the healthcare advocates on the left who are pro-choice, and went in and met with Speaker Pelosi and any number of members of Congress. It's interesting, we were talking about the one Republican who voted for the health care bill, Joseph Gao from New Orleans. He said that that was the last obstacle for him, too. He basically said, I wouldn't vote for it unless they'd gotten that amendment in.
Okay, well, let's go to one of the very, very many Republicans, of course, who voted against the bill. Congressman Michael Burgess from Texas joins us on the line. Congressman, thank you for joining the Diane Rehm Show.
Sure, glad to do it.
You voted against the bill. Explain your
vote.
You
bet. What's that?
Explain the vote.
The vote against it?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh, where have you been? where could you start? Here we have a 2,000-page bill that is going to fundamentally alter the way everyone receives health care in this country. We cut $426 billion from Medicare in order to create a new entitlement, but the new entitlement doesn't kick in until 2013 or 2014. The taxes, the $500 billion in new taxes, kick in almost immediately. Almost everything that moves under the sun, if it has health care stamped on it, is going to be taxed. It was a preposterous bill, and there were so many things we could have done. And I'll give President Obama credit. I mean, he did have the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical companies and the doctors in the room talking, and that was a step that had never been achieved before. And then they overreached, and it has created this nightmare scenario. And quite frankly, I don't think it is going to go anywhere in the Senate. It's hard to believe that it will. You know, you didn't pass it by much in the House, and the House is much more liberal than the Senate right now. It's just hard to see this thing being anything but dead on arrival over in the Senate.
Congressman, what did you make of the Republicans' bill?
I was disappointed. We could have gone a lot farther. I have, with Nathan Deal, who is the ranking Republican on the Health Subcommittee in Energy and Commerce, we put forward a number of bills this year to deal with the problems. The problems, quite frankly, that people were telling me about during the summer town halls, where they said they didn't want the big government takeover, but here's some things we do want fixed. Bills introduced by Representative Deal and myself, 4019 and 4020, deal with the problem of pre-existing conditions and rescissions, expand and really develop the what were called the high risk pools that were passed actually by Republican Congress a couple of Congresses ago, funds it at the level that the Congressional Budget Office said it should be funded, and does so without expanding the debt or the deficit. You know, when I was doing my town halls this summer, I mean, I heard from people all over my district who said they did not want this government takeover, but there were problems that need to be fixed. So trying to address those problems, I think, made some sense. And I think we have crafted some bills that go a lot further towards doing that. And look, even the Obama bill, if it's signed into law by Thanksgiving, the benefits don't kick in for so long, the people that are still being hurt by being frozen out of the insurance market, they don't have immediate help. We're still going to have to do something to make insurance available to them. Why didn't we do that first and see if we needed to do this other conglomeration?
Okay, Congressman Burgess, I'm joined here in the studio by Jonathan Allen. He's a congressional reporter, of course, for Politico. He has a question for you.
Sure.
Congressman, I know in your district the majority of your constituents probably see this as a bad bill, but I wonder, what do you say to the constituents who call you and say they do want some relief on health care reform, they want to see something progress, and maybe even some of your constituents actually like this bill? What's your explanation to them of what do you say to them on why you're not voting for this and not moving it forward?
Well, I think I'd have a lot more explaining to do had I voted for it by a factor of about 10 to 1. The people who are having problems do need help, and they have legitimate difficulties, and there was legitimate help that was within the purview and the grasp of the United States Congress to provide that, within the purview and grasp of state insurance commissioners to provide that. The fact of the matter is, we haven't done it. We expanded Medicaid. I mean, look, who in their right mind, if you were to sit down and say, here's a blank sheet of paper, and we want you to craft an insurance or a health care coverage system for people who are low-income, working poor, that are uninsured, you wouldn't sit down and create the Medicaid system, for crying out loud. You'd have to have, what, almost 3,000 waivers for the thing to work? That makes a lot of sense. No, you'd sit down and do something that made a lot more sense for people. And again, quite frankly, I'm really startled that we didn't do that. On either side.
Congressman, it seems to me that you weren't at all happy with the Democrats' bill, but you weren't happy with the Republican bill either. Are you dissatisfied?
Well, let's look at the Republican alternative was something we were, you know, it's a courtesy we're offered at the end of the debate. I mean, I don't think anyone who pretends that the Republican alternative was something that would work if that were the only thing legislatively that were out there. There's lots of bare spots there that would have to be attended to. The Republican alternative was meant more of I hate to use this term, but it's actually more of a it's just that it's providing an alternative for people who cannot vote for the Democrats' bill. What would you support? And some of those ideas were embodied in the Republican alternative. But just as when we were in power, the Democrats would offer an alternative. They're never meant to be sweeping pieces of legislation. The Democrats' alternative to the prescription drug plan in 2003, after all, would have cost three or four times what the Part D program ended up costing. So, when you don't have the majority, you don't have the resources to develop the legislation. The Republican alternative had sat for months without any attention from the House Counsel's Office, the Legislative Counsel's Office. It was impossible to get a Congressional Budget Office score until the last minute, and then you have no time to adjust it. Look what Senator Baucus did. All summer long, he was adjusting his Senate finance bill, moving cost and coverage numbers around to try to get that right mix and hit the sweet spot that wouldn't horrify people because of the cost but would still provide some coverage numbers. We weren't afforded that courtesy. We got one score, and then you had to go with it.
Okay, Congressman, just before you go, I want to ask you about a tweet that you sent out over the weekend saying that you've heard rumors that the American Medical Association may rescind their endorsement of the bill.
That's correct. And I obviously am not there. I am a member of the AMA, so I'm speaking just as a member of the AMA, and I was pretty discouraged by their supporting of the bill last summer before we even got to it in committee.
Where are the rumors coming from that you're hearing that they might rescind their endorsement?
Friends that I have down who are actually at the interim meeting down in Houston, that there was a vote to allow to bring the to bring this up for discussion either today, Monday, or Tuesday, and that vote passed on Sunday. So we'll see what happens.
Okay, we'll be watching that and watching the AMA's position over the next couple of days. Congressman Michael Burgess from Texas, thank you so much for joining the Diane Rehm Show.
All right, thank you.
Okay, and we're joined now by Congressman Jerry Connolly, a Democrat who represents Virginia's 11th Congressional District. Congressman, thank you so much for joining the program.
My great pleasure, Kathy.
What was the main reason that you voted in favor of this health care bill?
Well, I feel that the preponderance of this bill moves us forward. It provides a meaningful set of reforms. It is deficit neutral. It is fully paid for. And it actually brings down the cost of medical care with respect to the federal deficit in the first 10 years by about $30+ billion, and even greater in the second 10 years. And that's better than any other bill that's been presented, including the Republican bill Mr. Burgess was just talking about.
You are, of course, president of the freshman class. Are you worried that some of those freshman members are saying to you, look, this bill is making our futures in the House difficult, that is, we're looking ahead to those midterm elections, people that are in vulnerable seats, as we saw from Charlie Cook, 7 of the 10 most vulnerable Democrats voted no on this bill. Clearly, there's a lot of anxiety amongst Democrats in conservative seats who are saying, look, this bill is going to cause us problems.
Well, every individual member of Congress has to make his or her own decision with respect to the needs of their constituency and you know, how far they can push the envelope on legislative initiatives. The overwhelming majority of freshmen voted for this bill, and all of us come from, with a few exceptions, swing districts or marginal districts that have been carried recently by Republicans. So I think there are a lot of profiles in courage on health care, but the reason at the end of the day ought not to be about whether I come from a marginal district and my, you know, some people may not like that or it might hurt me. I think I really do think in this particular case it's kind of a higher calling. You know, what are we going to do about health care and how are we going to do it? The country desperately needs some kind of health care reform that is fiscally responsible, but that reaches certain goals. You know, we address the 36 million Americans that aren't currently covered by health insurance that the president talked about. We bring down the cost of prescription drugs for senior citizens. One of the most universal concerns I hear in my district is the horror stories people have about insurance companies cherry-picking and making capricious decisions every day because of a previous existing condition. And this bill, unlike the Republican bill Mr. Burgess was just talking about, actually makes that illegal. And I think that's a huge step forward for all American families in alleviating them of the anxiety they currently have as to the nature of their health coverage, even if they have insurance.
I'm Cathy Kay. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join us, please do call 1-800-433-8850 or send us an email to drshow@wmu.org. Congressman, before you go, I have Jonathan Allen in the studio. He's from Politico. He has his hand raised. He'd love to ask you a question, too.
Sure.
Congressman, the pay-fors for this bill are one set, at least half of it is one set of tax increases, largely talking about increasing taxes on wealthier Americans. The Senate right now is looking at tax increases on insurers, on drug companies, on medical device manufacturers, on Cadillac insurance plans. It's a whole other set of tax increases. Is this going to be difficult for your members to vote for when something comes back from conference and they're being asked to cast votes on a whole other set of tax increases that can be used in campaign ads?
Well, we'll have to see what, you know, let's remember back up. Roughly $500 billion in this bill and in the Senate bill is paid for by identified cost savings verified by the Congressional Budget Office. Another $400 billion is what's called the pay-for, and that's financed primarily in the House side, as you indicated, John, by a surcharge on the wealthiest one-third of 1% of American families who make more than $1 million. It, by the way, pretty much affects only 1% of small businesses across the country. So it's very, very limited in who it affects. And the rationale is that's the population that really benefited from the Bush tax cuts in the previous 8 years, and giving back a little bit for health care reform might not be a bad idea. I think that has broad support, even with the public. I think it's a much better way of going with the new thresholds that I fought so hard to get, because I thought the earlier thresholds for that pay-for were way too low. And frankly, I couldn't have supported the earlier version. So I was very pleased to make the fight, along with many in my class and others in Congress, to get that changed. So I think that's a responsible way to finance this bill as we move forward. And in an ideal world, I'd like to have no need for any pay-for, that everything would be identified with savings. And maybe as we move forward, we can get some additional savings. As you know, we tried to get the Congressional Budget Office to actually give us credit for preventive health care measures, which are loaded up in this bill and are good things. But CBO can't get its arms around that and therefore scored it as virtually zero.
Okay, Congressman Jerry Connolly from Virginia's 11th District. Thank you so much, Congressman, for joining the Diane Rehm Show. Janet Hook, we heard there from Republican Michael Burgess, from Jerry Connolly from Virginia. What were your thoughts on what both of them were saying?
Well, Congressman Connolly, as the president of the freshman class, reminds me of one thing that's very puzzling and worth noting. The idea now is that junior members and conservative members see this as a politically risky vote. I mean, it's very interesting how the framework of the debate has changed, because back during the campaign, when Congressman Connolly and President Obama were running, everyone was for health care reform. The concerns about health care costs rising were so high that, you know, John McCain, the Republican presidential candidate, was calling for big changes in the health care system, and just about every Democratic candidate for Congress. And now, if the Republicans have succeeded in one thing, they've managed in framing it as this is a scary vote for a Democrat to take, that your constituents aren't going to like it. When in fact, I mean, the bill does include provisions that addresses a lot of the problems. So we'll see how they handle it in the campaign to come.
Very interesting point. Janet Hook, reporter with the LA Times. 1-800-433-8850 is the number. We will be taking your calls. We've got a lot of congressmen calling in, of course. This is the Diane Rehm Show. We're talking about healthcare reform.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary on the web at healthreform.org, by the Gruber Family Foundation to extend the breadth and depth of NPR's international coverage, and by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
Life behind the Iron Curtain. A daughter delves into secret police files in Hungary to discover the truth about her parents, how they were spied on and betrayed. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Cathy Kay of the BBC. Sitting in for Diane, we are discussing the House bill on healthcare reform that passed on Saturday night. I'm joined on the phone by Congressman Jim Marshall, a Blue Dog Democrat from Georgia. Congressman, you voted against this bill. Why?
I did. I think we're just missing a rare opportunity to address the principal problem with healthcare that drives so much of the cost. And it's cost to taxpayers, it's cost to individuals who buy insurance policies, businesses that buy insurance policies, and heaven forbid that you wind up being a private pay patient, the kind of cost that you'll incur. What we've done over a 60-year period is dramatically expanded access. That's a good thing. We've really helped an awful lot of folks. But we chose a path that basically eliminated a normal market where healthcare is concerned. Ask people all the time these days, in order to try and illustrate the point, how does the Pentagon know what to pay for a hammer or a toilet seat? The answer is it doesn't. We know that the Pentagon has paid too much for a hammer and a toilet seat when we can see what they cost in a private market. And we basically don't have that now. I feel very strongly that we should try to move away from the third-party payment system totally dominating healthcare and move more toward, or back toward, I guess I should say, a market system for most of healthcare where patients have control of cost, responsibility, and control for their own healthcare costs.
So, Congressman Marshall, to what extent were you weighing the concerns and the messages that you were hearing from your constituents in Georgia against the pressure from the Democratic leadership, which was saying this bill might not be perfect, we understand that, but we do have to do something about healthcare reform, and this is a historic opportunity to push this bill forward?
Well, I missed the first part of your inquiry.
To what extent were you weighing the views of your constituents against that pressure from the Democratic leadership?
You know, what I was trying to do is actually figure out what is the right thing to do under these circumstances. This is a tremendous problem facing the nation. Some 46% of health care costs are paid for by tax dollars, federal, state, local. The lion's share is federal. We, by any fair measure, and all economists, financial analysts agree with this, by any fair measure, are on the verge of bankruptcy. And health care is the lion's share of the reason why we are on the verge of bankruptcy. If we can get control of these costs, it not only helps consumers, it helps the federal government generally. And I'm convinced that we can dramatically reduce cost, maintain quality, perhaps improve quality, and at the same time expand access if we would simply try to migrate back toward a market system and away from the third-party payment system. There's a great article that was written by a guy named David Goldhill in the Atlantic. It was published in September. It's called How American Healthcare Killed My Father. You can find the article online by just Googling that, How American Healthcare Killed My Father. It gives you an excellent analysis of how we got into this mess. So in my case, it's not pressure from leadership or pressure from constituents. It's just trying to figure out what's the right thing to do for healthcare consumers, for those who are having trouble accessing the system, and for the country at the same time.
Okay, Congressman Jim Marshall from Georgia, thank you so much for joining the Diane Rehm Show. And let's go to Congresswoman Lynn Woolsey, a Democrat from California. Congresswoman, thank you for joining the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you for having me.
You voted in favor of this bill. You were listening just there to Congressman Congressman Marshall. I just wondered if you could pick up on his reasons for voting no and the questions, a lot of questions about whether this bill goes far enough in cutting costs.
Well, as a matter of fact, that was one of the reasons the Progressive Caucus that I co-chair with Raul Grijalva wanted a robust public option because it would make sure that there was competition and that the premiums would not increase at the same speed they've been increasing over time because there'd be competition. But the manager's amendment of this bill includes language that will ensure that states review any premium increases before they take effect, and healthcare providers, excuse me, insurers that raise their premiums out of the ordinary will not be included in the exchange. So we're doing the best we can, and that's one of the major issues is controlling costs. But at the same time, the rest of the civilized world provides health care that's affordable, available, and good quality to their constituents. Why can't we?
Congressman, I want to put to you a question that's come into the Diane Rehm Show by email from Susan Davis. Susan writes to us, I keep hearing that the House health care bill will cover 96% of the people. Who are the other 4%? And why doesn't it cover them?
Well, it would cover them if they wanted to be covered. You see, there are individuals that we think are not going to be covered. And that would be maybe young people that feel invincible. And it will. And of course, we know it doesn't cover illegal immigrants.
And what did you make of the abortion debate that happened over the weekend and the moves to change the bill in order to satisfy the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops?
Well, my first impression is I had no idea that the Catholic bishops were elected members of the House of Representatives. But my second, more important impression is that we have a lot of work to do when the bill is in conference. And there are many of us that will not vote for a final bill that comes out of conference that actually does a good job to increase health care for America, but does it on the backs of women, and we're not going to allow that to happen.
Congresswoman, I have Janet Hook here from the LA Times who's in the studio. She wants to ask you a question as well.
Okay, hi, Janet.
Hi, Congresswoman. I'm interested in whether you and your the fellow members of the Progressive Caucus see this as this glass is half empty or half full, because you did have to make concessions on the public option to get it passed, the anti-abortion language. It's the bill as a whole is less ambitious than you expected. You say you won't vote against the bill if it comes out of conference without some of those things changed. I'm wondering how good is the prospect that it will get any more liberal? Isn't this the kind of the high water mark for your winning at the party?
Well, I don't think so. Quite often, as far as abortion goes, the Senate can be more pro-female than the House is. So there's a good chance that they'll be able to fix the language. And it must get fixed. So if we want health care reform, then we're going to not do it on the backs of women. And for the progressives, we started, you know, we wanted a single payer. So we really compromised when we moved to the robust public option. And that's why we're insisting that insisted that in the manager's amendment for the less robust public option that we have a language that will control the premium increases, because that's what the robust public option did.
Okay, Congresswoman Lynn Woolsey from California. Congresswoman, thank you so much for joining the program.
You're welcome.
Let's go to the phones now to Alice in Brighton. Alice, you've joined the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to comment on the disingenuousness of the conservative Republicans who talk about Medicare and the cuts to Medicare and what a tragedy that is, when these are the same people who would never have voted for Medicare 40 years ago, who rail against a single-payer public system, when that's certainly what Medicare is. And just wonder if any of your panel has any comments on that.
Okay.
I've happened to work in the aging network for the past 35 years, so I've certainly seen life expectancy and the quality of life increase in older Americans because of Medicare.
Okay, Alice, I'm going to put your question to Janet Hook. Janet, Alice's comment.
Yes, the Republicans focus on the Medicare cuts, as they call them, is interesting because, you know, back in the 1990s, when they were in charge of Congress, they also saw in Medicare an opportunity to make what they called then savings. And that's sort of what the Democrats are doing. It comes actually down to a question of whether or not you think there is waste in the Medicare program and in the health care system that could be squeezed out. And it inevitably gets to be politicized, whoever is trying to do the squeezing.
Okay, I'm going to go to Barbara in St. Clair, Missouri. You've got another question, Barbara, on the issue of the Medicare cuts.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
This is a very important topic. And what disturbed me is I had just received a piece of mail here that reminding me that the Medicare annual enrollment begins November the 15th. Now, this envelope on the heading is under AARP, but it also is Medicare Complete from Secure Horizons. Now, I got to reading through it, and it says, AARP is not an insurer, but they are paid a fee for their trademark. This really disturbs me, especially after hearing the comment about maybe the AMA endorsement may be pulled. Now, could someone comment on that?
Okay, Barbara, I'm going to put your question on that. I've got Jonathan Allen from Politico. He's sitting in the studio ready to take that point.
I think a lot of people would be surprised at how many pots AARP has its fingers in terms of business that goes beyond sort of what you would expect of an advocacy organization for. I wanted to say senior citizens, but AARP actually covers down to the age of 50, so I don't want to offend those who are in the window there. But they do a lot of different things, and they make a lot of money off of various things. I haven't seen, obviously, this one particular mailing that Barbara got, but it wouldn't surprise me if they're being paid for their trademark.
Jonathan, I want to ask you a question that's come in from Christine in Dallas, Texas, by email. Christine writes to us, I'm a middle-class voter with good insurance. How is this bill going to help me? Our income will disqualify us for subsidies, and our taxes will almost certainly be raised. Please explain to me how the government paying the insurance company's tax dollars is going to lower health care costs. To say I'm disappointed in this bill is an understatement. I believe insurance companies are the problem, as does 70% of the population. They don't need competition. They need to be regulated and phased out.
Well, I think the idea here, at least from the Democrats' perspective, at least part of it is this woman's middle class right now. She's doing well. But if she wasn't middle class tomorrow, and that we've seen with this huge housing crisis and the financial meltdown that people's situation changes pretty quickly, that this provides a lot of protection for them, particularly, and this is something we haven't talked a whole lot about, the inability of insurers under this bill to deny people coverage based on pre-existing conditions. I think people get very scared when not only could they lose their job and their house, but also lose their ability to get health insurance coverage because of some sort of condition that the insurer decides is not smart for them to pay for on an actuarial basis. So that's a big part of this bill, and it's one that's actually bipartisan. If they wanted to pass a bill tomorrow in the House and in the Senate and get it signed by the president that eliminated the pre-existing stuff, they'd have almost complete agreement. I think you might get a couple of votes against it, but obviously they need that to be part of the driver to get this larger bill through.
I'm Katty Kay. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join us, we have a few minutes left on the program. Do call 1-800-433-8850. Do send us an email as well to drshow@wmu.org. We're going to go to Chris in Silver Spring, Maryland. Chris, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Is government? I have a couple questions. Is government too big to fail? Could this lead to like a quasi-reformation movement where some states like Texas, who I believe can secede from the union if they want to? And isn't this ideal based on old European socialism ideals instead of something innovative like tradable tax credits to cover the uninsured, sort of like the carbon tax credit? And one final one, if my insurance company tweaks my insurance, does that mean I'm thrown into a government option plan?
Okay, Chris, I'm going to put those questions to Janet Hook from the LA Times. Janet.
Well, first of all, the question of whether this represents old European socialism versus a more radical change, I think it's neither one. And actually, that's sort of interesting because nobody's talking about radically changing the fundamental basis of our health insurance system. Most people, like 80 to 90% of people, get it through their jobs. And this bill, and indeed even the Republican alternative, just built on that. So it's not socialism. Most of the money, most of the insurance is coming from the private sector anyway. And the Republicans have talked in other settings about a more dramatic change that would go towards a more market-oriented approach, but they're not advocating that in the current setting. And I think nobody's ever going to be forced into the public option. If your insurance company tweaks your policy, I think you'll still have your policy, and then you get to decide whether you want to stick with it as they've changed it.
Okay, if I could piggyback for a second on what Janet said, I mean, I think one of the fascinating things that gets lost in all this discussion is exactly what you said, which is that this is the same system with some tweaks on it. It's not a massive overhaul of the American healthcare system. I think there were some people who wanted to see that wanted to see a single payer system, that wanted to see something that would get in the direction of really a government healthcare program, and that's it. And they got absolutely nowhere. You heard Congresswoman Woolsey talk about how they had to make a huge compromise just to get to the point where they were talking about a public option, and then they had to compromise from the public option that they wanted to this smaller public option with a little bit more of a market orient to it. So it really isn't a massive overhaul of the system. What it is, though, is insuring tens of millions of Americans who don't have insurance now and making some of these tweaks like the pre-existing conditions issue, which a lot of people have been worried about for a long time.
We've just got a minute or two left on the program, and I want to ask what happens next. The bill now goes to the Senate. What happens there?
Well, the Senate is going to take a long time, I think, to get this done. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid hinted that it wouldn't happen until next year, then quickly pulled back from that after a visit from Rahm Emanuel, the White House Chief of Staff. But even when they get the bill to the Senate floor, if they're able to, and there are some procedural hurdles to that, it should take weeks to debate this. There will be amendment after amendment. It's a long process. One way to look at it is the House passed the prescription drug bill in June of 2003. They didn't get a law until late November of 2003, and that was a much less complicated bill. I think the odds that we're looking, well into next year for final completion of this are pretty high.
Janet?
Yes, because as long as the Senate's going to be taking, then there's one final stage, which will probably be even more difficult, which is reconciling the differences between the House and the Senate bills. It's very hard to get a coalition to support it. The one thing that they'll have going for them is, given an up or down vote after all of this debate, it's probably going to be very hard to kill the bill that comes out of conference.
But there's going to be a lot of pressure on the Senate now, of course, between now and Christmas.
Absolutely.
And we'll see if any of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops get elected to Congress, as Lynn Woolsey was talking about earlier. Between now and then, they may run.
Jonathan Allen, congressional reporter for Politico, Janet Hook, reporter for the Los Angeles Times, thank you both very much for joining me here on the program.
Thank you, Katie.
We've been discussing, of course, the House passage of the healthcare legislation that passed on Saturday evening. I'm Katie Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thank you all so much for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.